Well, good evening. Can I welcome you to the Ira Raymond room for this meeting of the Friends of the Library? I firstly acknowledge we meet on Kaurna land and say how delighted I am that so many people have come out on a cold night. And the reason you've come, of course, is that this is an exceptionally exciting book. I'm sure that some of you have read the book already, but Peter Monteith and Valerie Munt have written together, which I think in itself is pretty clever. I don't know how people write a book together. I was asking them earlier. They've written together a book that manages to do all the things you want from a book. You learn something you'd never heard about before. You find out about an extraordinary individual. And when it's actually written in a sort of ripping way that moves along quickly so you can't put the book down, it's got all the ingredients of excitement. I don't know if anybody in this room is an anthropologist. I can't tell by looking at you. I'm sorry, I was looking around the room to see if I recognised any, but, you know. This is a story about a man who was an anthropologist, I think, before the profession really existed, and made his way extraordinarily around the world and ended up defecting. And what a wonderful story. So if I could ask Peter to speak to us, and then at the end of his presentation, any questions will go both to Valerie and he. So, Peter, thank you.
Thanks very much, Jane. It's quite a mysterious figure, which is why I've opened with this slide of Fred. You might recognise it as the image of him that we've used on the cover of the book. Mysterious because although his daughters tell us that this is from the year 1946. We're not exactly sure where it is. He was living in Canberra then, but it somehow doesn't look like Canberra. And we don't know who took the photograph. We don't know who the mysterious figure is stepping out from the shadows, but there's a kind of Cold War atmosphere here which is quite appropriate for our story. I don't want to tell it to you. I'd prefer it if you bought the book and read in detail, but I thought that what I might do to whet your appetite is talk a little bit about how Valerie and I came to write the book and how we went about writing the book and what sorts of things we looked at, consulted, in order to come up with this biography of a person who was tantalisingly unknown. And in doing that, I'll show you some images. How did we come to the topic? It started as a piece of diplomatic history, I think is fair to say, really quite a modest project where the interest was in trying to work out how it came about that Australia recognised, granted official diplomatic recognition to East Germany, the GDR, the German Democratic Republic, in 1972, and I was aware that this was one of the first things that Gough Whitlam did after he became Prime Minister. So before he recognised the People's Republic of China, and before either Great Britain or the United States recognised the GDR, Whitlam did. And the attraction was, it seemed it would be possible after the collapse of the GDR to follow that story from both sides of the Berlin Wall, so to speak. That is, we could look at Australian documents and we could look at East German documents. And that's exactly what happened. We followed this story. We were able to access documents telling the story from both sides. And what happened in that process was that in the East German documents, this name Fred Rose kept coming up, and it became clear that in the GDR, Fred Rose was the expert on Australia. He was the go-to guy when issues of Australia came up. One of the things that we looked at in doing that project was the files of the Stasi, that's the organisation's called the BSTU, and this is an organisation which holds kilometres of files, and it was suggested to me that even for this piece of diplomatic history, this might be a useful source. because there was a department of the Stasi which was interested in international espionage. And so that was indeed something that was worth having a look at. And you get a sense of that right at the beginning of the book, because there's a story there about Gough Whitlam gathering in 1976 at the Opera House and meeting with the Australian ambassador. This is one of those stories that comes out of this kind of material. And so frequently did Fred's name come up that the idea occurred, perhaps out of this curious figure, this guy who, for whatever reason, had decided to leave Australia and live in the GDR, perhaps there was going to be enough material to write at greater length about him. So we investigated a bit further. Who was this guy? An anthropologist, what did he write? And it was easy enough to access his published works. You might gain some benefit yourself. Some of it is very anthropological in focus. His classical work was The Classification of Kin, Age, Structure and Marriage Amongst the Groote Eylandt Aborigines, published in 1960. But a much more accessible work would be his book Australia Revisited, which was about his travels to and in Australia and his locking of horns with the authorities in Australia. He wrote a book called The Wind of Change in Central Australia. That too is a very accessible piece of work, partly about his anthropology, but partly also about his experience of working in Central Australia. Probably the breakthrough, though, in deciding whether it was worth pursuing Fred further as a biographical subject was the knowledge that in the Mitchell Library in Sydney there were 40 boxes of stuff that had been deposited. This was the Rose Collection. Didn't even have a catalogue number because no one had looked at it in any detail. It had simply been deposited in the library. And when we looked at it, we saw that it offered all sorts of treasures, manuscripts, correspondence, photographs, and in among all of that was a document titled Memoirs of an Unapologetic Anthropologist. And so the story was that Fred, at the end of his life, was writing his memoirs, and this manuscript was deposited within these 40 boxes of material. And that, of course, was extremely useful. We had at least his side of half of his story, because he died as he was writing them, or in the end dictating them, and the memoirs stop in 1954, a very important year in his life. Next to that, in Australia, there were ASIO files. These two, you can have a look at them yourselves. Some of them are digitised, and you just have to go to the National Archives website and type in Frederick George Godfrey Rose, and up they come, some of them. And these are full of insights into Fred, at least from a particular kind of perspective. And then to go back to the other side of the Iron Curtain. Again, we turned to the Stasi, and the first time we looked to that source, we were given access because the way it works is that if you're writing a study, you have to give a reason. Why do you need to access this material? If we ourselves had been in some way victims of the Stasi, we would have the right to have automatic access. But as outsiders, so to speak, we had to make the case, and so I had to make the case again and say, this is a different project now. I'm interested in writing a biography of Fred Rose. Do you have anything about Fred Rose? And my thinking was that because this guy was an Australian who'd gone to live in the GDR, it seemed highly likely that the Stasi would have taken an interest in him, not realising that actually Fred was the one who was taking an interest in others. And not only that, when I'd first looked at the collection as it dealt with this question of recognition. Sure, Fred was there, but it wasn't a lot of material. And it was only when I went back later and with a different question that I was surprised that they wheeled in a trolley with a mass of material on it. And luckily their approach to dealing with the material was different the second time around. The first time around, they wouldn't deliver original documents. They delivered only copies that were very heavily redacted. Lots of stuff was blacked out. When I went back the second time, they'd changed the rules. And if you were there reading the material, you could have the original files and nothing was redacted. So these names that would otherwise have been blacked out were now visible to me. Technically, I couldn't use them. Also, if I had anything copied, they would copy a redacted version. But sitting in the reading room there, this was a fantastic resource for us. So it was clear there was enough stuff in Australia, in Germany, to some extent in the UK, to do a biography, and so we set upon this task with the idea that we try to tell this person's life from both sides of the Iron Curtain. Fred was long since dead. Whether that's a good thing for a biographer, I'm not sure. You can argue the toss there, I think. Had he been alive, there's lots of stuff that we would have loved to ask him, because there are for us still many question marks about Fred. On the other hand, I'm sure he would have had very firm views about the kind of biography that might have been written. And certainly what we've come up with is a lot different from what Fred was writing at the time that he died. There's no mention, of course, in his memoirs of his involvement with the Stasi as one example. So Fred was dead, but we learned that three daughters were still alive, two of them living in Germany, one in Canberra, and we took up contact with them. The first one we had contact with was Ruth. She herself was an academic at the university where Fred had worked, the Humboldt University in what had been East Berlin. And Ruth, over quite some time, this book had a long gestation, altogether has been helpful, but I think it's fair to say also very ambivalent. On the one hand, she very much loved, admired her father, knew that he would have liked his story to be told. But I think she also knew that if somebody dug into the family history, there was going to be a lot of dirty laundry revealed. And she never offered us much of that dirty laundry. So Ruth, for example, never said, why don't you try the Stasi material? Although she knew that it existed. And then beyond that, for example, when she knew that we'd consulted that anyway, she didn't say, you might look at Edith, her mother's file as well. I mean, we looked for that anyway, but she wasn't offering stuff. She largely left it to us to do the work, but then as that process unfolded, she was supportive, or as supportive as you could hope for. Sonia too was quite helpful, living in Canberra, had a different perspective on her father, and Nita too of the daughters was the one most reticent, I think is fair to say. Then there were others who knew Fred, and of many, the one that I might single out first is the last of his lovers. This is Anke Bornschein, and she didn't mind that we used her name. This is a very elderly Fred just before he died. The age difference is not far short of 50. And she clearly put Fred on a pedestal. This was a relationship which came to an end only because Fred died. She thought very highly of him. She was very supportive of this idea that someone should at last write a biography of Fred Rose, and so was very open in sharing information with us. She came to know him in an interesting way. She is very interested in Indigenous issues the world over, and was asked to look after a visiting Indigenous Australian rock band called No Fixed Address. And because she was going to chaperone this group, she thought she'd better find out about Australia. Who did she turn to? Fred Rose. And one thing led to another. This is Anke with a couple of members of the group on the Baltic Sea. And this is No Fixed Address in, if you know East Berlin, that's the Alexanderplatz. And I single them out a little bit because Anke told me, she emails occasionally, that on the 3rd of June the band is going to be accepted into the South Australian Music Hall of Fame at the Goodwood Institute. So Anke was extremely helpful. It did, of course, pose for us the questions about what to do with aspects of Fred's personal life, how to deal with it as biographers, and raised a number of ethical issues as well for us as we wrote the story and shared it with people who had shared information with us. But we decided, I think, early on that this was, as a biography, not to be an academic biography. It wasn't to be just about Fred as anthropologist, it wasn't to be a political biography, it was to be a biography which covered everything, because as we saw Fred, all of those aspects of his life were interconnected in some way, in any case. Another person who helped us, but unfortunately didn't live long enough to see the publication of the book, was Peter Worsley, also a communist, became famous later above all as a sociologist, and is credited with introducing the expression third world into English. He came to Australia in the early 50s because he wanted to do anthropological field work in New Guinea, but when he arrived in Australia it was discovered that he was a communist, and so they blocked him. And at the end of his tether almost, Fred, who had become a good friend, came to his rescue and arranged for him to go to Groote Eylandt to do his field work there. Otherwise, Peter Worsley's academic career might have been a very short one. So Peter was extremely helpful. He read drafts of some of the chapters and gave us some useful advice. Another one is Vladimir Kabo, a Soviet anthropologist, and also an extremely interesting man, pictured here in Moscow with his second wife, Alena Govor. Vladimir was the Soviet expert on Australia, had spent decades studying Indigenous Australia, but never came to Australia. He was Jewish, he suffered in the Soviet Union, he spent time in the Gulag. Eleanor translated Fred's last book in 1987 into Russian, and she explained to us, she lives in Canberra, that she toned down the Marxist jargon in it, for the sake of pleasing the readers in Glasnost-era Soviet Union. But Fred worked very hard to enable Kabo to come to Australia, and he too was still alive as we were starting work on this project. And then of those who helped us, here's one who is still alive. This is Eric Bogle. Eric Bogle went to East Berlin in 1985 to participate in what they call the Festival of the Political Song, and got to know Fred. And here he's invited to Fred's apartment in East Berlin and talks with some of Fred's students. And we record the content of that conversation that evening in the book. So with the written sources, the contact with these and other people we knew had some kind of contact with Fred, students, colleagues, and so on, we set about writing this biography. And to a large extent, it's quite a conventional kind of biography. We tell a story of his life from his birth in London in 1915. He goes to school in London. He goes, because he's a very bright student, it becomes clear very soon. He gets a scholarship to go to Cambridge University. He studies at Cambridge in the 1930s, discovers in his third year in Cambridge that he loves anthropology, and decides really that what he wants to do with his life is become a great anthropologist. And in posing that question, how do you become a great, renowned anthropologist, decides that what he really needs to do is some field work in an exotic location. What would be better than Australia? Because there was still that perception in the 1930s that if you wanted to encounter societies in a traditional form, then Australia was one of the few places where you might still be able to do that. So he went to Sydney. He made contact with the anthropology department, the only one at that time at Sydney University. He came to know Elkin, who was the doyen of anthropologists in Australia, who helped him a bit, but later became his nemesis. And still had to solve that problem, how do I do field work in Australia? And came up with a very cunning plan. He decided that he would have himself trained as a meteorologist. And as a meteorologist, he would be sent to Northern Australia and have the opportunity to study Indigenous Australians. And that plan works a treat. He does his training in Melbourne. At this time in Australia, there's a need for meteorologists because the aviation industry is on the march, if that's not a mixed metaphor, in full flight. And they're flying from Australia to Britain and back, but with planes that have limited range. And one of the places where they build a base where these planes can land on the water is at Groote Eylandt in the Gulf of Carpentaria. And the place where they set up a base is here. And on one side of this bay or lagoon, little lagoon, is a place called Umbacumba. And on the other side is where they build an air base. Fred works in Darwin for a while and then he gets his transfer to Groote Eylandt. This is a photograph of Groote Island at Umbacumba. Now, it's a pretty dull photograph. The reason I put it there is because this tree is a tamarind tree. And tamarind trees were planted in various parts of the island and East Arnhem Land by Macassan trepangers. So people who had come from Sulawesi would come annually, and to mark the spots where they would make their annual camps, they planted tamarind trees. And it's a sign already that, in fact, this idea that you could study an indigenous community that was fully untouched by the outside world was, from the beginning, a flawed idea. The beauty, though, was for Fred that at Umbacumba, while the base was being built across the bay, he could stay and use the services of a fellow Englishman by the name of Fred Gray. This is, by the way, what's left of the base itself, very little. When the range of aircraft expanded, there was no need to land at this place, so the base was wound down. But this is the old fuel tank built by Shell. This is the detritus of civilization that's still there. And this is what's left of the landing from which people would emerge from the plane and make their way onto the base. And that's what it looked like in Fred's time when they were still building the base on Little Lagoon. And this is Fred. He's now a meteorologist. Seems to me that meteorologists don't have a whole lot to do. I think you send up a balloon once a day and check the rain gauge, and in the rest of his time he could put on his pith helmet and be an anthropologist. And this is Fred Gray, who was of great assistance to him. Fred Gray had set up a camp at Umbacumba. It's a Macassan word meaning little waves. An Englishman. And his job actually was to try to prevent the indigenous people there, the Anandilakwa people, from gaining too much access to the Europeans who were building the base. And here's Fred with some of the people who gathered at his camp at Umbacumba. And here he is. There was on the other side of Groote Eylandt a mission station. And it was the missionary there, Philip Taylor, who had asked Fred to play this role of keeping the indigenous people separate from those who were working on the base. And so this is Philip Taylor, this is his sister, Elizabeth Taylor, and Fred Gray. One of Fred's own photographs. And this is Edith, not yet Fred's wife. Fred had met Edith, a German woman, in England when he was studying in Cambridge. She was working as an au pair in a place called Saffron Walden, a significant Quaker place in the UK. Her politics very much of the left. And she followed Fred to Australia and visited him when he was on Groote Eylandt. She went back with Fred a little bit later because after his first stint on Groote Eylandt, he went to his next posting in Broome. And then, with a better idea of what he wanted to do, he returned to Groote and did more intensive anthropological work, studying above all kinship. That was his big thing as an anthropologist, and imagined that he could do something really quite original in his kinship studies, because he thought that he could use photography above all. And so part of what he did was to try to photograph every inhabitant of the island. By his estimate, there were maybe 300 people. He took photographs of about 220 of them. This is number 77. His name's Culpeper Barra. He's also a man who helped Fred a lot do his field work. He helped Peter Worsley later as well. And as he took the photographs, he would ask each of these subjects questions about how they were related to other people on the island. He could point to the photographs he had taken of the others and establish these relationships and try to understand how they all believe themselves to be related to each other. As I said, after the first stint on Groote Eylandt, he was transferred to Broome. Before he went to Broome, he and Edith decided to marry. They married in Perth. While they were in Broome, Edith had the first of their children. This is Kim Rose, a photograph given to us by Nita. And this is Edith with Kim in Broome. And next to Fred here is a doctor. His name's Alec Jolly, and he was a communist. Not all that common, I think, in the medical profession, but a well-established communist, a good friend of Catherine Susanna Pritchard. He was Catherine Susanna Pritchard's GP. And he seems to have been quite an influence on Fred. Fred was already moving towards the left in his politics, away from his parents' conservatism. He had been exposed to people with leftist views at Cambridge. And under the influence of Alec Jolly, he takes the next step. Not in Broome, where there is no Communist Party, but after the Japanese bomb Broome in March of 1942, an event which both these men witness, they're forced to move south. They go to Perth, and together they join the Perth branch of the Australian Communist Party. This is Edith's father, sometimes known as Sir Richard Linder. In Berlin, there's an exhibition of so-called silent heroes of the resistance And he is one of them. He's featured there. He was a lawyer by training. Not a communist, but certainly a sympathiser with the political left. And a noted resistance figure because in his house, just outside Berlin, he hid Jews and slave labourers during the years of the Third Reich. And he also welcomed the Soviets as liberators when they arrived in that part of the world in 1945. A remarkable figure, he had international connections through Quakers and he was a Freemason as well. And he was very much behind sending Edith initially away from Nazi Germany to England and then later to Australia. So he himself has a very fascinating war, just as his daughter on the other side of the world has an extraordinary war. With Fred, the family then moves to Melbourne. Fred is still working as a meteorologist. And Edith too becomes a communist. Having moved to Melbourne, they both join Melbourne branches of the Communist Party. We come back to 1946. Fred, after the war, doesn't become an anthropologist as such. He becomes a public servant now with a different brief. He moves into the Department of Territories in Canberra. For a time, Edith and the children by now, there are three of them by 1946, they remain for a little while in Melbourne. But Fred moves to Canberra for his new job, and he remains very much a communist. So he joins the Canberra branch of the Communist Party. He becomes its treasurer. It's clear that he's very committed still to the communist cause. And the question is, how committed was he? Was he so committed that he committed acts of espionage? There's still some lack of clarity about this. What we do know is that at this time, period after the Second World War, there was a Soviet spy ring in Canberra, operating in large part out of the Department of External Affairs, involving people Fred Rose undoubtedly knew. But what did Fred himself do? The ASIO files show that he was certainly a person of suspicion. They observed him very, very closely. They intercepted his telephone. They watched him with eagle eyes for quite some time. One of the reasons they were interested in Fred was because at that time, British and American signals intelligence were able to intercept Soviet cablegrams. Among them, Soviet cablegrams being sent from the Soviet embassy in Canberra to Moscow. And after interception, there was the prospect of decoding them. And those decodes in this project, known as Venona, were showing that there were Australians who were passing on intelligence. It wasn't always clear who those Australians were because cryptonyms were used, not their real names. So Catherine Susanna Pritchard, for example, she was mentioned. She had the cryptonym Academician. Ian Milner, another one, was Burr, I think. Rick Throssell, Pritchard's son, was Pharaoh. And in this list of cryptonyms, there was one professor. And the suspicion was that this professor was Fred Rose. There's someone who's absolutely convinced that Fred Rose and Professor are one of the and the same, and that's an academic called Des Ball. But he hasn't produced the evidence to clinch this for us, and he's not able to show it to us. He's quite convinced that Fred was playing a role in recruiting agents and also passing on information, above all to this man, Wally Clayton, who confessed later in his life that he was indeed the super spy, the one who was the ringleader in Australia, was passing on intelligence. And he certainly knew Fred Rose. They knew each other quite well. Wally Clayton would arrive in Canberra. He would have copies of the communist newspaper, the Tribune. Fred would distribute those. At the same time, Fred would pass on the party dues which he had collected as treasurer. So there's no question that there was contact between these men. But what exactly Fred was doing beyond that isn't 100% clear. But it is explored in some depth in the book. Fred's world starts to fall in a heap in the middle of 1953. He's being watched very closely by ASIO. They're so suspicious that they move him out of his job. They offer him a job in the Office of Census, which he doesn't want, perhaps not surprisingly. Edith and the girls decide to visit Edith's father in East Germany. And so in June of 1953, they leave. Fred, at this point, abandons any hope of a career in the public service and purchases, with a partner, a cattle farm on King Island in Bass Strait. He becomes a cattle farmer. And while he's working his farm one day, he receives a visit. This is just after the Petrov defection. Two ASIO agents turn up at the farm and they tell him that he has to appear before the Royal Commission into Espionage, which he does twice. Nothing is pinned on Fred, and eventually, because there are no judicial proceedings to follow from this, he's free, in a sense. No chance of a public service job, of course. Has to sell the farm, works as a wharfie for a time, and then with the help of his father-in-law is able to get a job in East Berlin. So Richard Linder, who's a kind of pillar of this new state of East Germany, is able to arrange things in such a way, with some difficulty, that Fred can finally become an academic anthropologist. So in 1956, with the good grace of the Communist Party, he's permitted to leave. He settles in East Berlin, a place on the outer southwestern side of Berlin called Kleinmachnow. It's a long way from where he worked. So here he is resting one weekend. His work is at the Humboldt University. Quite quickly, he's elevated to a chair, even though when he first went there, he didn't even have a PhD. So they fast-track that. He gets his PhD. On top of that, he gets his second PhD and becomes a professor. But he still hasn't given up his love of Australia, continues to think of himself as an Australian, continues to want to do Australian field work. He still wants to be a great, internationally renowned anthropologist. So whenever he gets study leave, he wants to go to Australia. The trouble is that the Australian government certainly doesn't want him to go back to Groote Eylandt. And probably for good reason, because they know that a good part of what Fred wants to do is to spread the word about the sorts of conditions in which Indigenous people in Australia are living. So they successfully stymie his bid to return to Groote Eylandt. And as a backup, he goes instead to Central Australia, because he is able to work. They can't stop him visiting a privately owned station in the middle of Central Australia between Uluru and Alice Springs called Angus Downs. And he photographs conditions there, he does his kinship studies there, he writes about Central Australia. It's the next stage of his anthropological work. And at every step, 62, 65, 68, through the 70s, ASIO watches him everywhere he goes. Here he is arriving at Communist Party headquarters in Sydney. There's a secret operation still to photograph Fred. Here he's talking with Eric Ahrens, a prominent communist. And increasingly, he becomes involved in land rights activism, various indigenous issues, because he sees this as part of his brief as an anthropologist. He wants to use anthropology to change the world. Becomes involved in the Wave Hill land rights issue. This is a photograph he took in Darwin before going to Wave Hill. Through that activism, he becomes acquainted with, works together with people like Dimfna Cusack on the left, Andler on the right, Kath Walker, or Ujuru Nunnuckle as she became. And that's a good part of the anthropological work that he does. He combines it very consciously with political work through the 60s and through the 70s. All of this time he wants to use his work to make a difference. Back in East Germany, having been subjected to ASIO's attentions on the other side of the world, he joins the Stasi. And we describe in the book how that happens. They approach Edith first, interestingly. So it doesn't come as a total surprise to Fred when they knock on his door as well, asking him that he keep this to himself. He shouldn't tell even Edith that he's going to be working for the Stasi. And a career as a Stasi agent begins that lasts until the end of his life, because he does this very keenly. He readily accepts this offer. Clearly they had in mind that this might be someone who could be deployed outside of the GDR. He had a British passport, he could cross the Berlin Wall. And interestingly, this all happens in the early 60s after the wall is built. So he does work in West Berlin, he's sent to Munich. But they find out that he's not really much of a spy. Not for that kind of purpose. He's just not subtle enough. People know his politics because he tells them. So he's redeployed, he's given different kinds of tasks, primarily within East Germany, telling about his colleagues and what they're up to, and even talking about his family. That becomes part of what he does in his work as a so-called IM, an unofficial collaborator with the Stasi. Edith, as I said before, was the same. She joined first. She was also deployed into West Berlin. She too had the advantage of a foreign passport. She could cross over to the other side. She used to go over to the military missions in the West and report on what she saw there. And then Kim. This is Kim. Later in his life, you saw him in Broome shortly after his birth. The Stasi approached Kim as well. And here too, I had to make a special request. I thought maybe Kim too, given that Edith and Fred had been approached, maybe Kim was as well. And so very quickly, and I had limited time, I put in my request, and sure enough there were files on Kim Rose. But they were really interesting because Kim was approached in the late 60s, and it becomes clear over time that he doesn't want to play this game, that this is not for him. This is a young man who was born in Australia, spent much of his early life in Australia. He stayed with Fred in Australia until 56. Seems at first to adapt to life in a socialist state. But when the Stasi come knocking on his door, ultimately it becomes clear he doesn't want to. So he doesn't turn up to meetings. He's not going to play along. After which time he has quite a sad life. Kim. In his personal life, things don't go well. He turns to alcohol, he's sacked from his job. It's an altogether unhappy story. Whereas Fred, by contrast, who does everything that the Stasi ask him to do, he keeps his job, they publish his work, all his children go to university. The arrangement, in a sense, works quite well for him in a way that it doesn't for his son, Kim, who died in 1989. He had cancer of the esophagus, didn't go to a doctor, died at home in his flat. The body was discovered by Edith when she went to visit. So this is one of the sadder aspects of this Cold War world in which the family found themselves. Fred doesn't live much longer. He lived long enough to experience the collapse of the Berlin Wall, long enough to experience German unification, but he died then in January of 1991. Altogether, it's a fascinating and very unusual life. It's hard to think of many people who would have taken that choice to leave a place like Australia and settle in the GDR. Very unusual to find someone who lived to some extent in the world of modern Western European culture, but also understood so well the completely different cultural world of Indigenous Australia. So an unusual and fascinating life, but also our argument is a representative life, in a sense, if that doesn't sound too paradoxical, because he's very much a creature of the 20th century. Perhaps you've come across this notion that the way to understand the 20th century is as the age of extremes, the age of ideologies. It begins with the First World War, it's characterised by the struggle among the three great ideologies of the time: fascism, communism, and liberal democracy. And Fred knew all of those. He knew them at first hand. The 20th century then ends with the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1991. Fred, like Manning Clark, the photo was taken by Asio in 1962, was born in 1915, and they both died in 1991. So they're both creatures of the 20th century. In both cases, I think it's true to say that their lives are shaped by the 20th century. The difference is that the one on the left has, I'm sure, his own Wikipedia page, and at last count, I think, three biographies, whereas the one on the right, not so well known, still no Wikipedia entry, but at least he has a biography now. Thank you.